Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Wednesday, August 19th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. A lot of good out there still. Clear Lake trucker reunites family with cat. A Clear Lake family that moved to Georgia earlier this month has been reunited with its cat. That's thanks to a local trucker who traveled 1,850 miles in his semi-tractor trailer to deliver it. I don't know what I could possibly say to fully express what it meant to our family, said Matt Welter, a former Clear Lake resident. Just the type of compassion and human decency he showed toward a stranger is good old-fashioned Clear Lake values. Welter and his wife, Tiffany, and three of their four children moved to Peachtree City, Georgia from Clear Lake on August 6th for a job opportunity. Tiffany Welter, a human resources manager at Eaton Corporation in Belmont, was recently transferred to a facility in Georgia, months before the one is slated to close in North Iowa. 3 days before the Welters moved, their three-year-old male short-haired tabby, Franklin, got spooked by the movers and lodged himself above the basement ceiling. The family spent hours trying to retrieve the cat to no avail. "We did all we could aside from cutting a hole in the ceiling to get him out," Welter said. The Welters, already an hour and a half behind schedule for a reservation, decided to leave for Georgia in hopes of seeing their cat again. Franklin is one of the family's three tabby cats, Matt said, noting that he is his wife's rescue. Forrest is Matt's, and the third is with his oldest son, a freshman who decided to stay in Clear Lake with his mother to finish high school. Because Matt's mother planned to spend the next couple days in Clear Lake cleaning their house, the Welters trying to find someone with a live trap. Within hours, someone who lived nearby placed a baited live trap at the house, and the next morning, Franklin was caught. However, when the couple found it had cost more than $2,000 to have Franklin transported from Clear Lake to Georgia, they knew they had to consider other options. "We couldn't afford that," he said. "We love him and all, but we just moved across the country, so we thought the next best thing was to find him another loving home." The family shared Franklin's story on Facebook and asked if anyone would be willing to take him in. Matt said he received four or five private messages from individuals interested in rehoming their cat before he received the one that changed his family's life. Travis Anderson of Clear Lake had seen the family's Facebook post after he returned home from delivering a load, and although he didn't know the family, he wanted to help. "They were in a bind, and there was no other way he'd get back to them," he said. "I didn't want to see it go to the shelter, and if worst came to worst, I was going to take the cat." Anderson, who had the opportunity to deliver a load to the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport the following week, reached out to the Welters on August 5th. Matt described Anderson's offer as a long-shot opportunity that would allow his family to keep Franklin. "We thought he was a member of extended family that was no longer going to be with us," he said. "All our options had been exhausted, and then this happened." Anderson, a 20-year trucker and cat lover, picked up Franklin from the Welters' Clear Lake home and took care of him until the two left for Texas. He said Franklin was pretty shy at first, but it didn't take him long to warm up to Anderson. Anderson and Franklin departed for their 1,850-mile, three-day voyage on August 9th. "He was a good little boy," Anderson said. "He got to see quite a bit of country, more than most people get to see. Franklin especially liked watching the airplanes take off from the airport," he added. The day after arriving in Dallas, the two left for Knoxville, Tennessee, where Anderson planned to meet Matt on August 11th. Matt drove more than 3.5 hours to meet Anderson, but he said it was the least he could do, given how far Anderson had traveled. Once he got to Knoxville, Matt placed Franklin in a kennel to prevent another Houdini act, and that's where he remained until they safely arrived in Peachtree City. Once he arrived home with Franklin, his family, including its cat, Forrest, was more than happy to see him. Matt said he and his family are eternally grateful to all of the people who made keeping Franklin a possibility, especially Anderson. "Through this situation, I became a quick believer that there's a lot of good out there still," he said. "We thought everything was dark, and the headlights of an 18-wheeler lit it up for us." Mason City officials present at All America City Awards. When it comes to presentations that are being judged, it's obviously good to make an impression. Having meaningful information is fine enough, but judges cannot live on facts and figures alone. A bit of pizzazz is needed, which is exactly what Mason City officials tried to bring to their Wednesday morning presentation before a panel of judges for the All America City Awards. As one of 20 finalists and the only city in Iowa to make it this far, Mason City officials had 20 minutes to argue why the town deserves such a distinction. To make the case, they indulged in some real-world satire. Fasten your seatbelts. We have an exciting road ahead, Mason City Administrator Aaron Burnett said at one point during the loving homage to the MTV reality show. Some of the markers on that road that Burnett, Mason City Mayor Bill Schickel, and Mason City Chamber of Commerce Program Director Kativa Wetzel pointed out, the ongoing River City Renaissance Project, a near doubling of city volunteer hours, and a workforce diversity program that business leaders insist are crucial to the long-term success of the area. During the presentation, which threw to officials across the city, Burnett called the River City Renaissance the embodiment of community collaboration and told judges that just the arena facet of the project had led to new businesses and housing in downtown Mason City. At another turn, Recreation Superintendent Brian Pauly shared that nutritional work his department is engaged in has led to 79% more kids in Mason City schools eating more fruits and vegetables. One other recreational endeavor the presentation spotlighted was the Chamber's Trees for the Town project, which had 15 contributions from local businesses and received a matching grant of $2,000 from the city to plant 54 trees in areas damaged by the flooding from 2008. When it came time for questioning, the judges started off by asking how the city figured out of which these sorts of projects were even community needs. We just saw a need to come together, and it's through this that so many of these things have been accomplished, Schickel said about some of the work. As for nearly doubling volunteer hours from 8,000 to 15,000, the judges wanted to know how the city measures the impact of such work. Mason City Volunteer Coordinator Mary Litterer was clear about that. The impact our volunteers make in the community is by their participation and also by the projects, she said. And to try and tie everything together, the judges also wanted to know where Mason City officials thought this was all heading. We don't like to talk ourselves up enough, and that's something Mason City is engaging in, is celebrating these accomplishments, Burnett said. We need to tell that story as much as possible. The presentation itself can be watched on the All America Awards Facebook page. The awards will be determined this week. Previous Iowa winners include Dubuque, Ames, and Des Moines. Mayors press Trump to act on aid for homeowners. More than once, President Donald Trump told Iowa federal, state, and local elected officials Tuesday that more help will be coming for individuals and households hurt by hurricane-force winds that ripped across Iowa over a week ago, carving a $4 billion and counting path of damage. We'll take care of it, the president said multiple times during the half-hour discussion in response to pleas from the mayors of Cedar Rapids and Marion, communities at the epicenter of the damage. We're getting it taken care of and done very quickly, said Trump, who Monday signed Governor Kim Reynolds' request for a major disaster declaration. The declaration makes funding available to state and local governments, as well as certain nonprofits, on a cost-sharing basis for emergency work and the repair or replacement of facilities damaged in 16 counties, including Lynn and Johnson. However, according to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Trump's declaration covered only the public assistance portion of Reynolds' request, about $45 million for debris removal and repair to government buildings and utilities. Her request for about $82.7 million to help those whose homes were destroyed or badly damaged was not included. FEMA says that still is under review. Also not yet approved is the $3.77 billion for estimated agriculture damage to farmland, grain bins, and buildings, and $100 million for private utilities repair. According to Iowa Homeland Security, the agriculture and private utility funding wouldn't come under the auspices of FEMA. Iowans need the individual assistance from FEMA, Cedar Rapids Mayor Brad Hart told Trump during the president's brief event at the Eastern Iowa Airport. The individual assistance is really important because almost every one of the community's 60,000 homes and businesses was damaged. Homeowners insurance, for those who have it, won't cover many of the expenses, including tree removal they face, Hart said. That could be tens of thousands of dollars, he said. So adding the individual assistance component to the disaster declaration would really help so many people get those trees out of their yard and not have such a financial burden. We'll take care of that, Trump said, and Reynolds assured the mayor the state is gathering the numbers needed to expand the declaration. We'll be able to add that on, and we should be able to do that in a short amount of time, she said. Marion Mayor Nicholas Abu Asali estimated that 90 to 95% of all homes and businesses in his city have some damage. Many businesses that had shut to slow the spread of COVID-19 had started to reopen. So the scale of this disaster will be devastating, Abu Asali warned. Okay, we're working on it, Trump said. It's a double whammy. The devastation of the derecho is taking a human toll, added Kim Ream, executive director of Mission of Hope in Cedar Rapids. The faith-based organization works with people in need, including those who are homeless. And this week, I became one of them, she said. Although confident her family will recover, Ream said others are not as fortunate and they need the federal individual assistance. Their physical needs are not being met, Ream said about the people Mission of Hope is feeding. Many of them have lost their shelter. They don't know where their clothes are. We're strong, Ream said, echoing other speakers. We're strong and we're resilient, Mr. President, but we are tired and we need your help. Trump also heard from U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, who the president described as an incredible man, and Iowa Agriculture Secretary Mike Naig about the impact on farms. About 113 million acres of crops have been damaged or destroyed, Grassley said. Naig told Trump central and east central Iowa cooperatives are reporting early estimates of more than 57 million bushels of licensed grain storage seriously damaged or destroyed. The co-ops estimate it will cost more than $300 million to remove, replace, or repair the damaged grain storage bins. In light of the damage done to the ethanol industry, first as COVID-19 reduced Americans' travel, and now by the wind damage to cornfields, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst told Trump he should not allow any waivers from the renewable fuel standard. Just dispense of those, she said. We just need help from the EPA to follow the intent of the law. We'll speak to them, Trump said. We'll speak to them. State Representative Ashley Hinson, a Republican from Marion, stressed the importance of repairing schools that suffered damage, catastrophic damage in many cases, similar to a hurricane. Well, we'll take care of it and you will make a fast recovery, Trump said. Hinson is challenging Democratic 1st District Representative Abby Finkenauer, who was not invited to the event. Finkenauer, who has been critical of Reynolds' efforts, spoke Monday to presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden and Finkenauer had a brief conversation during which she asked him to use his national platform to draw attention to the crisis in Iowa, her campaign said in a statement. She looks forward to engaging with anyone and everyone to bring much-needed resources to our state. Biden Iowa campaign director Lauren Dillon called Trump's stop a transparent attempt to save face in the state. One photo op in Iowa does not make up for 4 years of failed leadership, she said. Trump noted he is familiar with many of the counties devastated by the derecho from campaigning here in 2016. This has been a very loving area, he said about Iowa. Speed limit changes could be coming to Highway 122 in Mason City. Iowa Highway 122 in Mason City has a need for less speed. Tuesday night, the Mason City Council took its first steps in codifying speed limit change recommendations for that route. Recently, the Iowa Department of Transportation did a traffic engineering study of the Highway 122 corridor west of Monroe Avenue, and what it brought back was data showing that there was a higher than normal crash rate for the stretch of road. In turn, that necessitated a speed study to figure out whether or not the current limits were acceptable in maintaining safety. What the study brought back were recommendations for speed limit reductions. The boundaries for the recommended changes on Highway 122 are 460 feet west of Grover Avenue, 900 feet west of Taft Avenue, and 1,520 feet west of Indian Head Drive. The 40-mile-per-hour limit for that stretch of Grover Avenue would stay pat at 40 miles per hour, while the Taft Avenue and Indian Head Drive stretches would go down from 50 to 45 miles per hour. During the meeting, Mason City 3rd Ward Councilman Joshua Masson asked Mason City Engineer Mark Rahm whether or not the city was obligated to take any action on any recommendations found in the study. Rahm made it clear that such guidelines are, in fact, just guidelines, but the city is inclined to act on recommendations for areas where there are difficulties, such as the speed on Highway 122. "We don't just take everything at face value and move forward," Rahm said of the study, which runs some 300 pages. "We'll pick and choose, and it will take years to get there." While one of the largest bullet points in the study focuses on speed limit changes, which can be made quickly, there were other big-ticket recommendations in the study as well that would take years, like Rahm said. They've identified somewhere in the $7 to $10 million range, but that is on top end of everything, Rahm said about the Iowa DOT's findings. But that kind of work wouldn't happen all at once, and the financial burden for it wouldn't be entirely on the city. Rahm pointed out that the city would have multiple funding options for such work, including money coming from the state of Iowa. As for the speed limit ordinance changes, those will take two more readings at city council meetings before being approved. The possible speed limit change wasn't the only auto-related item of the night. The council also unanimously approved the Mason City Police Department purchasing 4 Ford Interceptor utility vehicles from Mason City Ford for a grand total of $141,400. In a memo from Mason City Police Chief Jeff Brinkley to Mason City Administrator Aaron Burnett, Brinkley said that the purchases were needed to replace current vehicles that are due for annual patrol fleet rotation. Mason City Ford was one of two bidders for the order, with the other being Stivers Ford out of Waukee. Along with those emergency service expenses, the council also discussed recent spending to address the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The city's financial report for July showed that COVID expenses for ambulances totaled $11,059, which was the costliest pandemic expense listed in the report. When asked about the numbers, Mason City Finance Director Kevin Jacobson pointed out that other COVID expenses in the report were often less than $200. He then went to say that summarizing such costs is important in applying for grant money from the federal government. Clear Lake School Board awards $10.6 million bid for Wellness Center. A local contractor has received its third and largest bid for a project included in the Clear Lake Community School District's $18 million bond referendum. The Clear Lake Board of Education unanimously approved Dean Snyder Construction's $10,624,140 bid for the 81,000-square-foot Recreation and Wellness Center to be built on district property south of the high school gym at 125 North 20th Street Tuesday evening during a special meeting. Dean Snyder Construction was among 7 contractors that submitted bids for the Recreation and Wellness Center ahead of bid letting on Thursday. The others were Henkel Construction of Mason City, Cresco Building Service of Cresco, Jensen Builders of Fort Dodge, Kingland Construction of Forest City, Sandy Construction of Humboldt, and the Joseph Company, Inc. of Austin, Minnesota. Dean Snyder had the lowest base bid at $10,210,000, followed by Cresco Building Service with $10,410,500, Kingland with $10,470,000, Henkel with $11,214,000, the Joseph Company with $11,400,000, Sandy Construction with $11,787,996, and Jensen Builders, $12,130,000, according to a bid tabulation provided by Atura Architecture. Bids were also submitted for 8 alternates, such as a multipurpose addition, an operable partition divider, alternate HVAC controls, 2 half-court dividers, pervious pavers, asphalt paving with pervious, and AF1 with painted striping. The estimated cost of the project, which is being done in collaboration with the City of Clear Lake, was $11 million, including the city's $1 million contribution. Dean Snyder's bid, including the multipurpose area, operable partition divider, alternate HVAC controls, two half-court dividers, asphalt paving, and AF1 with painted striping alternates, totaled $10,624,140, while Kingland's was $10,799,000, Cresco's was $10,799,535, Henkel's was $11,502,000, the Joseph Company's was $11,749,500, Sandy's was $12,210,776, and Jensen's was $12,512,000. G said it's the district's hope to start the Lions field work in mid-May and have at least the football area completed by the first week in August, weather permitting. The school board's vote Tuesday came more than 5 months after district residents passed an $18 million bond referendum. The passage of the referendum gave the school district the authority to issue debt for construction and improvement projects at its elementary school, middle school, and high school facilities. Dean Snyder also received the bids for the Clear Creek Elementary Secure Entrance at $515,230 and the Lions Field Athletic Complex at $2.4 million, projects in March and April, respectively. Both projects started this spring and are slated to be completed this fall. Construction on the Wellness Center is expected to begin on August 31st, and it's scheduled to be substantially completed in December 2021. Second person dies in LeClaire boat crash. A second person has died from injuries sustained in a boat crash on the Mississippi River on Sunday. Dr. Anita Pink, 52, of Moline, died at the scene, and Wednesday, Craig Verbecki, 61, of Moline, died at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics as a result of the boat crash. Both Verbecki and Pink were on board a 19-foot Bayliner. The two were engaged to be married in July 2021. Pink was a member of the Group Obstetrics and Gynecology Specialists, PC, and Revive at the Group Medical Spa in Davenport. The crash between a 1993 19-foot Bayliner and a 2007 35-foot Triton happened on Pool 14 of the Mississippi River near LeClaire around 7 p.m. on Sunday. Brooke Jewell, 36, of Bettendorf, was on board the Triton boat and suffered minor injuries and was transported to a local hospital. According to police, others were on board this boat as well. Investigators are requesting anyone with information that may have witnessed the crash or know anything about the crash to contact authorities immediately. Anyone with information should contact DNR Conservation Officer Travis Graves at 563-349-8953 or travis.graves, and that's T-R-A-V-I-S, travis.graves, at dnr.iowa.gov. Anyone wishing to remain anonymous may do so. The Iowa DNR continues to investigate this fatal crash. Moline police released two more people of interest in Trudy Appleby investigation. The Moline Police Department is releasing two additional persons of interest in the Trudy Appleby missing person investigation. On August 21, 1996, Trudy Appleby was reported missing by her father, Dennis, from their home in Moline. On the days leading up to Trudy's disappearance, she had asked her father to go spend time with a friend who resided on Campbell's Island. Trudy's father did not allow her to go swimming, but phone records show she may have planned to go ahead with her swimming plans. In August 2017, the Moline Police Department released information that a witness observed Trudy Appleby with William Ed Smith in a late-model silver Chevrolet four-door near Smith's residence on Campbell's Island on August 21, 1996, and listed William Ed Smith as a person of interest in the case. Smith is now deceased. The Moline Police Department has developed two additional persons of interest in the disappearance of Trudy Appleby. David L. Whipple, 59-year-old, from Kelowna, Illinois resident, and Jameson A. Jamie Fisher, 45-year-old, Silvis, Illinois resident, have been developed as persons of interest in the Trudy Appleby investigation. David Whipple is the son-in-law of William Ed Smith, and Jameson Fisher is a lifelong family friend of the Smiths. The Moline Police Department is requesting the community's assistance regarding any information about William Ed Smith, David Whipple, and Jameson Jamie Fisher and their involvement related to the disappearance of Trudy Appleby. The Moline Police Department is asking anyone with information regarding these individuals, the events on that day, and the days immediately following to come forward and help bring justice for Trudy Appleby. Please do not assume that we know what you may know. No information is insignificant. Anyone with information is asked to call Crime Stoppers at 309-762-9500 or call the police department directly at 309-524-2140. Iowa County says clinic failed to report 3,000 COVID tests. An Iowa county said Tuesday that a clinic failed to report up to 3,000 negative coronavirus test results as concerns about inaccuracies in the state's official pandemic data continued to mount even as schools use it to determine their fall plans. Webster County Public Health Department spokeswoman Kelly Bloomquist said her agency uncovered the clinic's failure to report negative tests last week, and the clinic belatedly submitted the 3,000 results. The county didn't say why the clinic was not reporting the negative results. The state system rejected the submissions, but a subsequent review confirmed that many tests had not been entered, Bloomquist said. The new information dramatically reduced the county's 14-day positivity rate, which the state is using to determine whether school districts must return for at least 50% in-person instruction. The Fort Dodge Community School District announced late Monday that the lower positivity rate would allow school to start on August 25th as initially envisioned. Last week, the district announced a plan to delay the start date given the seemingly high level of community spread following a major outbreak at a prison. Separately, Humboldt County School District Superintendent Jim Murray said he learned Tuesday that the county positivity rate of 22.6%, the highest in the state, will be lowered once unspecified data errors are corrected. He said the district would not seek a waiver to start online. The Associated Press reported Monday that potentially thousands of positive coronavirus cases have been backdated due to an error in the state system. The problem appears to have artificially lowered many local positivity rates, independent researchers say. U.S. Representative Cindy Axne, a Democrat from Iowa, called the news a gut punch and called on the governor to fix the problem and explain what it means for current positivity rates. Without clear accountability and answers, Iowans don't know the risks and facts about COVID-19 in our state. We need Iowa officials to fix this problem and restore our confidence in data, Axne said. The governor's office and Iowa Department of Public Health were silent on the problem for a second straight day, including its cause, scope, and plans to fix it, despite promises that more information was forthcoming. Pat Garrett, a spokesman for Governor Kim Reynolds, initially said information would be released Tuesday, but said it would now be released Wednesday. A department official previously said that a system error skewed the numbers involving people who tested positive after having earlier tested negative. Their new positive results were erroneously recorded as having happened when their original negative results were reported, often in March, April, or May. Rita Gergely, a retired Iowa Department of Public Health official who has been independently tracking the data, said it was a very unfortunate coding error that had been made worse by a lack of transparency from the state. She estimates that the error could affect up to 100 cases per day. Gergely said that she felt terrible for her former colleagues. It's just really, really, really bad luck for it to happen. It is a nightmare for them, she said. It's going to affect some counties a lot more than others. Mercy One North Iowa adds new doctor to its staff. For the latest addition to its staff of doctors, Mercy One North Iowa went local, about as local as possible. New doctor of osteopathy John Lee joins the Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center as a native of Mason City and a graduate from North Iowa Area Community College. According to a press release from Mercy One, Lee, who specializes in surgical pathology and cytopathology, first became interested in medicine by watching his father practice as a physician. When he was in medical school, he gravitated towards pathology because it gave him the opportunity to help people and provide patient care while being able to work in the lab, the release goes on to note. Surgical pathology, in particular, involves removing tissue from patients in order to study it and make a diagnosis. Lee just wrapped up his med school residency in June of this year. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Wednesday, August 19th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Janice A. Beznoska, 1944 to 2020. Janice Ann Beznoska, 76, of Mason City, died on Saturday, August 15th, at the Mercy One North Iowa Hospice Unit after a courageous battle with cancer. A private family service will be held at a later date. Interment will be held in Rudd Evergreen Cemetery at a later date. Memorials can be directed to the family of Janice Beznoska. Online condolences may be left for the family at MajorErickssonFuneralHome.com, and Erickson is E-R-I-C-K-S-O-N. Janice Ann Beznoska was born in Charles City on May 2, 1944, to parents George and Emma Hess Tettmeyer. Janice attended school in Marble Rock. At a young age, Janice was united in marriage, but later divorced. Between this union, the couple had three children, Scott, Billy Joe, and Julie. Janice worked as a waitress. She also worked for Rockwell Collins International. In 1988, she was united in marriage to Ken Beznoska, the love of her life. With this union, her family of four became a family of seven. Janice and Ken were married for 31 years. Once united in marriage, Janice moved to Nebraska City to join Ken. After Ken's retirement, the couple moved back to Iowa, settling in Rudd before moving to Mason City. Janice enjoyed spending time outdoors. She especially enjoyed gardening and weeding around the Rudd Lake and the flower beds. She loved playing hostess and having get-togethers making baked goods for those that were in attendance. She was always willing to lend a helping hand and made sure everyone's belly was full. Janice was very proud of her children and loved spending time with her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Janice also loved her dogs, Ty, Lady, Buddy, and most recently Molly. They all held a special place in her heart. A fond memory that she and the family had was meeting in Omaha when she lived in Nebraska City to spend time at the Omaha Zoo. Janice is survived by her children, Scott Schaefer and spouse Robin, Julie Begeman and spouse Craig, Billy Joe Palmer and spouse Rick, stepchildren Leah Splitchell, Frank Beznoska and spouse Mariah, grandchildren Jennifer Reinke and partner Steve DeBurr, Jessica Jeffrey and spouse Andy, Lindsay Mullenbach and spouse Brian, Lauren Lundberg and spouse Caleb, Emily Dietz and spouse Chris, Eric Palmer and partner Genesis Faust, step-grandchildren Joshua Beznoski, Nicholas Beznoska, Zachary Beznoska, Kelsey Beznoska, Jaden Beznoska, great-grandchildren Christian and Colton Reinke, Lincoln and Liam Jeffrey, Carson and Madison Mullenbach, Kenzie Lundberg, Dre Palmer, Jordan Dietz, and Lane Palmer, siblings Lois Fisher and Thelma Nixt, sister-in-law Marla Tettmeyer, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her husband, Ken Beznoska, parents George and Emma Hess Tettmeyer, siblings Irving, George, Paul, and Alan Tettmeyer, and Marie Nordman, and great-grandson Blake Lundberg. Vera M. Stockberger. Vera M. Stockberger, 92, of Mason City, died on Wednesday, August 12th, at the Good Shepherd Health Center. Services will be held at a later date. Online condolences may be left for the family at MajorErickssonFuneralHome.com. And again, Erickson is E-R-I-C-K-S-O-N. John F. Platts. John Francis Platts, 56, of Mason City, died Tuesday, August 18th, at Mercy One Hospice of North Iowa. John's wishes were to be cremated, and due to the COVID-19 pandemic, a celebration of life will be held at a later date. Shirley J. Osterman, 1935 to 2020. Shirley Jean Kuchenreuther Osterman, 85, passed away August 10th in Corning, California, after a lengthy battle with Alzheimer's. Her funeral will be private, though a visitation will be held at First Baptist Church on Friday, August 28th from 3 to 5 p.m. in Forest City. Cheryl was born on February 2, 1935 in Algona to Harold and Davida Billsborough Kuchenreuther. She graduated from Algona High School in 1953 and met her future husband, Gene, at a skating rink in Algona that same year. They married in 1955 in Waukegan, Illinois, and soon moved back to the farm. There, they raised four children and built a wonderful life together. Their marriage lasted until Gene's death nearly 5 years ago, 1 week shy of their 60th anniversary. She and Gene sought to honor Jesus Christ in every aspect of their life together. Cheryl had a great gift for hospitality. Her home was often full of guests who were greeted with good food and a warm welcome. The freezer was always stocked for guests. She was a vibrant woman who loved flowers and rich colors, especially purple. The Christmas sweaters she chose for her grandchildren often reflected that preference. She also sewed many clothes and sweaters that are treasured keepsakes. Cheryl was also known for her sass. When she thought someone was getting a little too big for their britches, she would roll her eyes, cluck her tongue, and let out a loving but exasperated, "Well." Cheryl is survived by her daughter, Deb Miller, and spouse Bruce of Corning, California, son Michael Osterman and spouse Carla of Clyde, Kansas, son Scott Osterman and spouse Pat of Woden, her sisters Karen Hammer and Barbara Davis, her brother Larry, her brother-in-law Wayne, 17 grandchildren and 27 great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her husband Gene, son Stephen, and two brothers, Jerry and James, her sister Phyllis, and brother-in-law Donald Osterman. St. Ansgar football relishing underdog status. For the first time in recent memory, the St. Ansgar football team will go into a new season as underdogs. At a recent Saints football practice, a shrill whistle pierced the air, announcing the end of the day's drills. The players gathered at a distance to listen to head coach Drew Clevenger's post-practice speech, each and every one of them with a mask covering their nose and mouth. With everything the team has to prove to itself this season, the program is taking no chances with COVID-19. Every player is required to wear a mask as soon as they enter the facility, and it stays on until they leave, coming off only for the most intense of conditioning drills. "We tell our players to be selfish," Clevenger said. "By wearing a mask, you're not selfish. That's actually a very selfless thing to do. But selfishly, if wearing a mask gets us to the first Friday night where we can all play, that is a good thing to do." The Saints come into the 2020 season with a lot to prove. Last year, the team came within 3 yards of an appearance in the state title game as quarterback Cade Duckert was pushed out of bounds late in the game on the fourth down in the Saints' 23-21 loss to Grundy Center in the state semifinals. Gone this season is standout running back Jack Sievert, who finished with 2,095 rushing yards in 2019 and tied for the state lead with 39 rushing touchdowns. Duckert is gone too, along with 7 other seniors that the Saints will have to find a way to replace. Luckily for the Saints, Ryan Cole will return to help lead an offense that finished 2nd in the state in 2019 with 4,592 rushing yards. As the team's second halfback last year, Cole finished with 1,143 yards, 20 touchdowns, and an average of 9.9 yards per carry. Senior Carter Saltz will also get some snaps in the backfield after rushing for 337 yards a season ago. Though the loss of Sievert will definitely sting, the remaining backs are confident that they will be able to pick up the slack. To Cole, it doesn't matter who gets the glory as long as someone scores. "I'm really expecting that all of us are going to do really good as a unit," Cole said. "All of us have become unselfish, and we really want to block for each other. It's really exciting seeing one of your best friends get in the end zone as much as it is you getting into that end zone." The Saints are a team that has repeatedly felt the sting of coming up just short. Since winning a state title in 2011, St. Ansgar has yet to make it back to the championship game and has fallen in the semifinals in 3 of the past 4 years. For seniors like Cole and Saltz, this year is their last chance to raise a trophy of their own. "It's definitely really frustrating coming up short every year, but we use that as motivation, not only in the weight room, but out here on the practice field," Saltz said. We're pushing guys under us to keep getting better, and we're getting better ourselves. That is our big goal, to win state. Like every other team in Iowa, the Saints will be playing a shortened 7-game schedule that will include a lot of sanitizing and social distancing. In 2020, every team will make the playoffs due to possible schedule complications if teams have to miss games because of positive COVID-19 tests. While teams usually have to scrape and fight their way into the postseason, so far, coaches and players throughout North Iowa seem to like this year's new setup. I'm really pleased with the IHSAA for the leadership that they are showing, Clevenger said. These are trying times, not only for football teams, but for everybody. They're allowing us to do something that is important to the kids, is important for communities, and is important for schools. They're trusting us to do the right thing. Clevenger knows that the team has a lot of work to do before the season begins in 10 days. With young players taking over in several key spots, mistakes will probably be made early in the year, and there will surely be some bumps along the way. But as the coach puts it, if you can do the little things right, big things will eventually happen. After the sting of last year, the Saints are eager to make it back to the Unidome. First, they have to earn it. We've fallen short, and maybe last year in particular, it felt like maybe we left a little bit of meat on the bone in terms of what we were capable of, Clevenger said. You use it as motivation. Anything we did in 2019 isn't going to help us win football games in 2020. These kids have to be responsible for whatever happens this year. The Saints will have to beat some tough opponents this season to make it back to the Dome, and Clevenger is anticipating some hard-fought games, especially the regular season finale against Lake Mills on October 9th. Lake Mills, you could probably say, is the favorite in our district, Clevenger said. I don't think there's any doubt about that. We're the underdog. We're not used to being in that role. We'll see what we can do. The Saints will open the season on the road on August 28th against Osage. Editorial, Rebuild It and They Will Come, Reviving Iowa's Local Food System. And this is written by Aaron Lehman of the Iowa Farmers Union, Krista Smith of the Iowa Association for the Education of Young Children, and Halisa Johnson of Northeast Iowa Food and Fitness Early Childhood. Iowa needs to think big on local foods for the health of our children and economy. Recently, the Local Foods Healthy Kids Initiative was launched to promote recommendations that get more locally sourced healthy foods into the hands of Iowa's youngest children and grow our local foods industry. The emerging market for locally sourced food, which includes childcare providers and schools, represents a great opportunity for Iowa's farmers. Iowa was once a leading producer of apples, grapes, sweet corn, melons, potatoes, and many other fruits and vegetables. A century ago, Iowa led the world in canned sweet corn with 58 canneries. Today, Iowa has no processing and packaging facilities for horticulture crops and minimal transportation and storage operations for a local food system. Yet, fresh fruits and vegetables are crucial for a healthy diet, and locally produced food is fresher, tastes better, and contains more nutrients than food grown thousands of miles away. Good nutrition improves a child's ability to learn. Access to locally sourced fruits and vegetables support a child's understanding of farming and the impact of food choices on health, and work to create lifelong preferences for healthier foods. We also know Iowa's agricultural industry lacks diversity. The average age of an Iowa farmer is nearly 60, and 94% of our cropland is planted in corn and soybeans. But there is an increasing interest in younger generations to reconnect with the land, how our food is produced, and a desire to produce fruits, vegetables, meat, poultry, and dairy for local consumers. It is time for Iowa to connect these dots and grow our local foods industry and address the lack of access to and consumption of healthy foods by our children and all Iowans. That is why the Iowa Farmers Union, the Iowa Association for the Education of Young Children, and Northeast Iowa Food and Fitness Initiative partnered with funding from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation to launch the initiative. The recommendations respond to a statewide study of stakeholders led by the State Public Policy Group, which finds that the local food system is fragmented and public investment in the needed infrastructure for our local food system is minimal. Farmers markets are a wonderful addition to our communities, but alone cannot sustain a vibrant horticulture industry or grow our locally produced meat, poultry, and dairy businesses. To reach a scale that will support transitioning more of our farmland to horticulture crops, we must build the infrastructure needed to sustain a local foods industry. It can be done because we have done it before. Iowa will always be a world-leading producer of corn, soybeans, hogs, poultry, and cattle, but our research has shown there is a growing demand for a safe, reliable, and healthy local food system. That has been reinforced by the negative impact of COVID-19 on the safety and reliability of our food supply. This is our "if you build it, they will come" moment. Iowa policymakers should support this effort and provide the leadership needed for success. We must capitalize on the opportunity to grow our local farm economy while improving the health and well-being of all Iowans with healthy, locally produced food. A letter to the editor. Restoring Iowa's soil health is critical. As I write this, much of Iowa is suffering from a significant drought, just when the crops are at a critical final stage of development. As we've seen many times before, the right amount of moisture is critical to Iowa's farm economy. Too much or too little moisture can have devastating effects. Whether it is drought or extreme flooding, we are starting to understand that improved soil health can help make a farm more resilient. How? Healthy soils absorb water like a sponge and actually store it for plant growth when needed during drier times. Likewise, that ability to absorb water also prevents a lot of runoff. Degraded soils do the opposite. They shed water and cause runoff during heavy rains, filling local streams with rushing floodwaters and fertilizers. They also lose moisture during drought. Since colonial times, America's once fertile soils have lost more than half of their organic matter, a key sign of soil health because the beneficial bacteria and fungi in our soil live off of that organic matter. By adding just 1% more organic matter to a field, soil can hold 20,000 gallons of rain or more per acre. Restoring the health of Iowa's soils through better conservation practices, such as no-till and cover crops, is one sure way to do this. Healthier soils also mean increased profits for Iowa farmers. To achieve those benefits, farmers need unbiased advice. That's why we should support our soil and water conservation districts with the resources they need in assisting farmers. We cannot restore the health of Iowa soils overnight, but the sooner we help farmers adopt better soil health practices, the better the millions of acres of Iowa cropland will be able to store water for that next drought or absorb those heavy rains that cause flooding downstream. Signed, Lawrence Hibbs, Charles City. Waterloo okays mask mandate. On a 6-1 vote, the Waterloo City Council on Monday passed a resolution adopting a mask mandate, but consequences for not following the measure weren't immediately clear. Council member Jonathan Greider introduced the resolution as a way to guard against spreading the coronavirus. Fundamentally, I understand free choice. However, when someone's free choice could potentially hurt someone else, whether it's an individual or a community, government has long stepped in order to protect the community as a whole, Greider said. Councilmember Sharon Juon, who supported the resolution, compared the mask mandate with laws requiring using seatbelts and yielding at stop signs. They may infringe on personal freedoms, but they save lives, she said. The mask resolution would require face coverings in public when people aren't able to maintain a distance of 6 feet from others, as well as in businesses, city buildings, public transportation, and ride sharing. Masks won't be required when alone or with household members or while traveling in a personal vehicle. Other exemptions include when exercising, while obtaining services that require the temporary removal of face coverings, and when eating or drinking at establishments. Children under 2 are exempt, as are people with some medical conditions, public safety workers, and people who are unconscious or incapacitated. Council member Margaret Klein cast the only no vote, saying she hasn't given up any part of her life out of fear of the coronavirus, as she listed friends and elderly relatives who survived COVID-19. I believe this fear we place on people by sounding the horn of terror, I think we have to stop that. We are doing very well with what we have. We have masks. I respect masks when necessary. I think all the adults I run into are very aware of when they should and should not be wearing a mask, Klein said. Four people in the audience spoke out against the resolution, including John Sherbin, who noted state officials haven't required face coverings. "We've got a governor, we've got a president, we've got a lot of good people running this country. This is one of those state issue jobs. If the state says we need to do this and it's represented by the right people, fine. But our little city of Waterloo does not have the expertise," Sherbin said. According to the proposal, enforcement will be up to the mayor or his designee with the aim of compliance and not punishment. Council member Dave Bozen said the resolution doesn't have any teeth. Juan said the city should have looked at penalties for noncompliance. She suggested bringing up the matter of penalties in the future if there isn't compliance. Meanwhile, the Cedar Falls City Council is planning to set a meeting for later this week to discuss its own potential mask resolution. At the council's regular meeting Monday, member Frank Dara made a referral proposing the resolution. The council voted 5-2 in favor, scheduling the meeting to discuss the matter, with council member Susan DeBurr and Daryl Cruz dissenting. Biden officially secures his party's nomination. Trump campaigns in Arizona and Iowa. Democrats formally nominated Joe Biden as their 2020 presidential nominee Tuesday night, as party officials and activists from across the nation gave the former vice president their overwhelming support during his party's all-virtual national convention. The moment marked a political high point for Biden, who sought the presidency twice before and is now cemented as the embodiment of Democrats' desperate desire to defeat President Donald Trump this fall. The roll call of convention delegates came as Biden worked to demonstrate the breadth of his coalition for a second consecutive night. Former President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State John Kerry and former Republican Secretary of State Colin Powell were among the heavy hitters on a schedule that emphasized a simple theme: leadership matters. Former President Jimmy Carter, 95, also made an appearance. Grappling for votes and the spotlight as Democrats hold their national convention, Trump reached back Tuesday to the signature issue of his 2016 campaign to deliver a broadside against Biden over immigration. As Democrats gathered virtually, Trump targeted voters in the battleground states of Arizona and Iowa and sought to curry favor with women voters by pardoning Susan B. Anthony, a leader in the women's suffrage movement. News briefs. Virginia. A judge heard arguments Tuesday but did not immediately rule on whether to dismiss a lawsuit challenging Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's plans to remove an enormous statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee along Richmond's famed Monument Avenue. Middle East. Gaza's sole power plant shut down Tuesday, leaving the territory's 2 million residents with only around 4 hours of electricity a day after Israel cut off fuel supplies in response to incendiary balloons launched by Palestinian militants. 2020 Census. More than a half dozen cities, counties, and civil rights groups sued the Trump administration Tuesday, saying there was no justification for its decision to cut the 2020 census short by a month, and it will lead to the undercounting of minority communities and an inaccurate headcount of every U.S. resident. Absentee voting. President Donald Trump's reelection campaign and Republican Party groups are suing a third Iowa county, seeking to invalidate thousands of absentee ballot request forms that have been returned by voters. The lawsuit against Woodbury County's top elections official was made public Monday. Blackouts. California's power grid operators were keeping an eye on the thermometer Tuesday after avoiding highly anticipated rolling blackouts a day earlier as an ongoing heat wave stresses the electrical system. How sweet it is. Friends wind down summer with money-making venture. A group of young, motivated friends wrapped up their summer with a little extra money in their pockets after taking to the street with a punch and lemonade stand Tuesday afternoon. Using an upside-down recycling bin as a table and wielding a large cardboard banner, Isaiah Presby, 12, Izzy Brogdon, 11, and Keegan Cleghorn, 10, all of Mason City, along with Kagan's cousin Lucas Bitker, 12, of Clear Lake, set up shop in front of the laundromat at the intersection of North Rhode Island Avenue and 12th Street Northeast. Beverages sold for $1 apiece, with the profits split three ways. Izzy volunteered her time. Isaiah and Keegan are both hanging on to their money for a rainy day, while Lucas has his sights set on a Razor Spark scooter. Even though they saw relative success as far as lemonade stands go, the group said that meeting new people was the highlight of their venture. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Wednesday, August 19th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakrose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.